this week's session is the one that really started my thinking about the whole series, the whole idea of looking at King Solomon's life just in itself is worth doing, but then to look at it in particular through the lens of these books that are attributed to him. And this week we're going to look at the one that most fascinates me and that I least understand. So hopefully we can create a little understanding together. And that is the book of Qohelet. And I have to say that Ecclesiastes in the Latinate. And I have to say that there are three books that tradition ascribes to King Solomon in our Bible. And last week we looked at one of them, Mishle, Proverbs, and that was fruitful. There is one that we mentioned last week, but that we're not going to take a deep dive into, and that is the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, mostly because it doesn't discuss wisdom all that much, and that's sort of the meta topic here. King Solomon is the exemplar of a virtue or of a value that we've been investigating all along. And you know, I was thinking about the Song of Songs because there's a famous rabbinic teaching that Rabbi Yehuda says that Song of Songs is metame et hayadayim. It makes the hands impure because it's so full of filth. Like, how did this? The idea is that they're canonizing these sacred scriptures and they're putting together our Tanakh. And how does Song of Songs get in there? How did it get in there? It's this erotic love poem, like what's going on here. And of course now we're kind of used to a certain spin on it that sees that love, that sensual interchange as a metaphor for something divine. That's another class, but the point is it is rather shocking, and indeed some of the rabbis thought it shouldn't be in there. And then famously Rabbi Akiva comes in and says, Chas v'shalom, God forbid, that Song of Songs is metame et hayadayim, that Song of Songs renders the hands impure, because he says, kol haktuvim kodeshem, all of the writings are holy, but Song of Songs is kodesh hakodeshim, like Song of Songs is the holiest of all, which is his way of saying there's something in here that, yes, like not despite all of its imagery, but for all of its imagery, this is something we really need to grapple with and take a look at, and it does inform our religious lives, and hence the beginning of that sort of metaphoric, allegorical thinking. So they were shocked by Song of Songs, but I have to say, I think that Qohelet is a far more shocking book. Far more shocking book. If I had to pick one book that I just can't believe is in the Tanakh, it would be Qohelet. It would be Ecclesiastes. Because, you know, Eros, okay, we're like touchy around it, it's a delicate topic, but it's a celebrated part of human life, even in our tradition. The central theme of Qohelet might be nihilism. You know, I mean, that might be what we're dealing with here, and that seems much more provocative and radical within this tradition than any beautiful love poem, no matter how graphic. So let's dive in now and take a look at Qohelet. It is, as I said last week about Mishle, it is a difficult book. It's a strange and difficult book to understand for different reasons. But, you know, it says contradictory things that sometimes it seems to celebrate sensual pleasures like eating and drinking, and sometimes it seems to condemn them. And we're gonna pay a lot of attention to what it says about Chochmah. And there, too, we'll see sometimes Qohelet, Shlomo, we'll talk about that in a second. The author seems to celebrate wisdom and sometimes also to not exactly condemn it, certainly dismiss it. And that's what we're going to try and figure out tonight. But we have a way through. We have a method, and that is part of what I was so excited about in looking at the first two of our discussions and looking at the book of Kings, and then taking a look at some of these books as a way of, they're attributed to King Solomon, and obviously, you know, the authorship is debated, but the tradition is asking us to consider these books as if they were the writings of King Solomon. In fact, a really interesting midrash says, I've thought about this a lot, says that Song of Songs was written in Solomon's youth, that Mishlei was written in his middle age, and that Kohelet was written in his old age. And that in itself is just, we could just stop the class. That's a lot to think about there, like the way that this, all of the passion of Song of Songs might be the passion of a young man, and that Mishlei might be somewhere in the middle of life, the kind of confidence, but maybe pedantic confidence of middle life. And then maybe what we're going to look at are the reflections of someone who has lived most of life and now has a totally different perspective. And indeed, if nothing else by way of introduction to Kohelet, it is a totally different perspective. But we are able, because we've been talking about Solomon all along, to look at this book through the lens of Solomon's life and to imagine what this book might be saying if it were written by someone who had been the king of Israel, as it says that it is. That's the way that it starts. Mishlei explicitly says that it is written by, or at least, I don't know, dedicated to, and, you know, in the legacy of Solomon himself. But the first thing to say about Kohelet is that Shlomo has a different name, and that's how it begins. Divrei Kohelet ben David melech b'Yisrael. Now, there was only one son of David who was the king of Israel, so I guess this is Solomon. And Solomon himself had a different name. He was called Yedidiah and also Solomon. So maybe the, you know, people can have different names. So Jacob had a different name. But it's a strange one, Kohelet, and seems to have kind of a feminine ending. And if it is a feminine ending, it would be like a verb. It seems like it would be like the verb to bring together or to gather together, maybe the one who gathered together all these sayings. It's a little mysterious that it is the king here is Kohelet. The other thing, the funny thing that I remember when I think about the name Kohelet is the one of the Israeli satire programs, Hayudim Bayim, has this great skit. I mean, it has a lot of great skits, actually, about Solomon being kind of like a privileged, bratty, nihilistic, morose teenager. And, you know, Batsheva's knocking on the door like, Shlomo, Shlomo le. And he's like, Korim le Kohelet, ani lo Shlomo, ani Kohelet. Like he's chosen his own name. So who knows how he got the name Kohelet, but that's one explanation. But anyway, let's begin. Let's go into it. We are going to focus on, as we did with the book of Proverbs, we're going to focus on the sections of Ecclesiastes that speak directly to some of those major themes that we spent a lot of time thinking about when we looked at Solomon's life, the themes of wealth and wisdom. Sexuality will be less prominent here than, in fact, we won't deal with it nearly at all, although it's been a part of our conversation, so you can bring it in. It was very much, obviously, it's a part of Song of Songs. It was also very much at the forefront of the images that we saw in Proverbs. But wealth is definitely there, and kingship is definitely there. There are images again and again of a king. It's not just that a king wrote this, but that there are some reflections on what it means to be a king, which again will allow us to reflect on this as if through Solomon's life, and then, of course, wisdom. And of course, we'll be discussing wisdom as we have been doing, and we'll be saying now some very different things about it. And here's where I think it starts to get confusing. It's not entirely clear to me what we're supposed. I mean, the whole book is complex, but certainly what we're supposed to be taking away with respect to wisdom, it's not entirely clear to me. And I want to get clear because we've been doing this for 4 weeks now, and I want us to leave with some sense of what it is about wisdom that, you know, just repeat where we began, what it is about wisdom that is so venerated in this tradition, so supreme among our virtues. And when I say our, I mean there it is in our Tanakh, but also, as I've said, I think every time, our rabbis who took up this tradition, carried it forward, they celebrated wisdom, and they referred to their teachers as chachamim, and that was their supreme virtue. So what is it about wisdom that is at once so venerated, and at the same time, I think we have started to see, has proven to be kind of problematic virtue, one that can go horribly awry, and maybe go awry partially in and of itself, partially because there's something about wisdom that is precarious. Okay? So let's take a look, and we can do a lot of work just in the opening words of Ecclesiastes. They are very famous, and some of what we'll have to do is just figure out how to translate them. So, Divrei Kohelet ben David Melech Birushalayim, the words of Kohelet, son of David, king in Jerusalem. And then here, these famous opening words, Havel Havalim. Havel Havalim. Okay, so we're going to talk about this in a sec, but here I've translated it. Actually, I think I just left the translation as utter futility. Utter futility, says Kohelet, Amar Kohelet, Havel Havalim, repeats it, utter futility, Hakol Havel. Everything is Havel. Everything is futility. And then, so that's one, there's the nihilism for you. I mean, depending on how we define this, like what exactly is he saying there? That will be our first question of the night. And then the next line sets another great theme and kind of repeated trope that echoes throughout Kohelet. Ma'itron la'adam b'chol amalo shi'amol tachat ha'shemesh. What gain is there, or what advantage is there, or what gain is there for a person from all the work he does under the sun? Here, there is some philosophy that is at least being teased at, hinted at here, and to begin to, I mean, called it nihilism, you know, to be provocative, but I don't know if that's it. But let's just start with the word, hevel, or havel. What is that word? It is alternately translated as futility here. I almost retranslate it as emptiness. It also means like vapor. It's sometimes translated as vapor because it refers to the vapor of either the ether in the world or sometimes the breath, the vapor of breath. The world, Talmud says the world famously rests on Hevel Pihem Shel Tinokot Shel Beit Rabban, the breath of little babes who study Torah in their schoolhouse. Right? That's a nice expression of Hevel. So vapor, fleeting, passing, air, nothingness, emptiness. Vanity. That's another way it's translated. Vanity, vanity. Everything is vanity. That's a loaded word, so I didn't translate it that way. But, okay, let's just take some first passes at it. What might this mean? Everything is hevel. Everything is emptiness, vapor. Yeah. Let's begin.
So, like, for me, I mean, first of all, like, the connection to Bereishit again, because Hevel and Kain, one is established, whereas the other one is fleeting and transient. I've always thought of this expression, Hevel Havalim, is like, almost like, not that life is futility, but rather that life is ever-changing and impermanent. Mm. That's what impermanent.
Impermanence, good. Yeah, I can't hide anything from Rachel. I had this in my mind. Maybe I'll reveal the first time that Hevel is used in the Tanakh, but of course Rachel's got it. No, not at all. That's to your credit and to the credit of our learning. That is, great connection. The first Hevel in the Bible is not vapor or vanity. It's a person. It's Abel. Abel, right? Cain and Abel. And the Hebrew for that is Hevel. And Rachel's exactly right that there's some sense there, right? Cain is called Cain ki kaniti ish, because I have gained a man with the help of God. Maybe there Eve is talking about her husband, or maybe she's talking about Cain. I've gained, which would make Cain something, an acquisition, and then Hevel is kind of like nothing. And that sort of the valences of those names, they speak a certain kind of destiny, because indeed, Abel turns out to be, you know, like vapor. He disappears. He is nothing. He's there and then he's gone. So that is one way of thinking about this, is that it is the passing of something, the impermanence, and they're like kind of Buddhist overtones there, right? Like that maybe that we're saying something about the nature of the world, that all things must pass, and is that a terribly depressing thing? Is that a disheartening thing? Maybe, you know, I don't know if the Buddhists would say that, but like it certainly seems dark here. Yeah, bracha.
Yeah, it's interesting because going back to Rachel Beresh's image, Hevel, and you're talking about nihilism, Hevel was annihilated.
Uh-huh, right.
So, you know,
right.
That's like an immediate image that grabs you. At the same time, I'm thinking of...
That's so good. I never thought about the connection between those two words, but that's so good, right? Nihilism, a philosophy of annihilation. Yeah.
But maybe what we're meant to annihilate is this whole struggle that we have with life. You know, this sense of it's all worthless. Maybe that's what's meant to be annihilated. And if you look at the word Hevel and you juggle the letters, you can get Lahav, which is a flame.
Hmm.
So maybe we're supposed to play with that and not just accept it.
Good, okay. Is this Bracha As setting a theme and is it the opening statement of the book? Or is this a problem which needs to be solved, which we'll spend the rest of the book trying to undo this sense that everything is, you know, here's another word I could use, meaningless. That's not the right translation, but is that the connotation? Or no, is this the feeling that one can have when one looks out at the world, maybe especially when one is like, you know, has got it all or has lost it all, right? Like some of the legacies of Shlomo that we'll start to read into this. Do we have a sense that we need to figure out a way past this the emptiness of all things? All right, so then there's Hevel, and then also this idea, maybe this is the definition, or maybe this is just another statement, that, you know, we work all the time, we work all day under the sun. It's always under the sun here. It's like, I have this image of it's just like it's beating down on you. We work all the time, and, you know, what comes of it? What comes of it? So that's a different kind of statement. Yeah, Gerard.
It seems to me that he gives the conclusion and then he will spend the next 12 chapters to prove his theory.
Mm.
So when he says that everything is futile or everything is vapor, and if we think of the opposition between Cain and Abel, Cain is the creation of civilization. You mentioned wealth. So Cain creates cities, creates civilization, creates something that is heavy, that we can is materialistic, that we can touch.
Yeah.
Abel, by opposition, is everything that is not concrete,
mm-hmm.
not solid. And so it seems that Kohelet is saying, don't try to stick to what is materialistic, and I will prove you during the next chapter that nothing is important. Everything that you deem, yet you thought was important in your life is not so important.
Yeah.
And it's a response to the Greek philosophy at the time. So there's a connection here. It's as a literary device, it seems to me that it gives the conclusion first and proves the point.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, there's a lot in there. I mean, that's an interesting way to think about the legacy of Cain is human civilization itself, right? Cain's descendants going on to build weapons of war and cities and not, you know, all the things that we do as human beings. And maybe that's one way to think about, so I want to save your point, which is the material construction of the world, the things and the towers, you know, like the towers of Babel and the towers that we build today and the stuff and the violence and the acquisition and the possessions that Kohelet will be reflecting on we'll soon see all the stuff that he builds up. So that's materialism versus, as the way Gerard framed it, is like versus some vapor spiritualism, some other way of some legacy that Abel never got to have of a different approach to life that was maybe about, I don't know, the spirit, the ideas, the something else, some other way of living. But I also heard in the description you gave a kind of, and one way we might look at this book, is a kind of reflection on humanity itself. Like, this is what, maybe the problem is us, we, people, you know? Like, the problem is not God or the world or the animals or existence, but the problem is what Adam, Adam, Adam. We keep repeating what Adam does. And Adam is the one that brings violence into the world. And Adam is the one that creates destruction, right? As Cain did in his kind of opening act. So there's something about civilization itself and all of the excesses. I mean, and I'm struck by that. I'm building on the point that you made. I'm struck by that in part because I think that's a philosophy that we are in our contemporary conversation sort of having again, right? With looming environmental disaster. Are we the disease? Like, are we the problem here on Earth? The animals, seem to be going about their business. Right? And we're so proud of our civilized nature, but maybe that's actually just the problem. So that's another way to think about the problem with the book is not just that life is bent to meaningless and destruction, but that we are. Yeah.
Oh, I was just thinking as you were speaking that the other thing about Cain and Abel is that Cain is a farmer and Abel is a shepherd, and that's the first use of another very powerful. Mm-hmm. Throughout the Hebrew Bible,
mm-hmm, yeah.
The Lord is my shepherd, the idea of a wandering shepherd tending to his flock. And that's also here. He's not a shepherd, but when you think about it, it's the idea, and Cain's punishment is to wander the earth right after he kills his brother. Mm. So rather than being established, which is the other root that kind of corresponds to his name, in New Nation, but it still looks like, Hava Kayam.
Mm-hmm.
Established in one place, he has to wander.
Right.
And so
he has to become a shepherd.
He basically has to become a shepherd, yeah.
Right, there's that great phrase, Vayeshev Kain Be'eretz Nod. Like he settled in the land of wandering, literally.
Yes.
Which is like one of those like paradoxes that the Bible is so great at putting in just a couple of words. Like that's our sort of impossible duality is that like we build and we construct things and also we are unsatisfied and still moving and restless and wandering, and that's what Cain was. And I don't want to draw Hevel's such a good touch point, and now we're using Cain as another, and well, let's go back to Shlomo soon, but there's something to this. There's something to this, like maybe the problem goes all the way back. Yeah.
Susie, I'm just thinking that in respect to the people I know who are inheritors, that a lot of things feel like pointless and futile to them, like when they're trying like build up their career or just do things in general, like the best thing they almost can do to preserve their own wealth, for example, is to spend less than 4% of their assets.
Right.
And do all sorts of other things. And so, in some ways, wealth can suck someone's motivation for doing things. And it's possibly in their life they feel like, oh, maybe these things that they were doing weren't really so fruitful.
Yeah. Good. Okay. I'm so glad you said that. So there's a couple things. One is, surely we will reflect on the unique. It isn't just any person here. It's a powerful, wealthy person. And that is the frame for our ruminations here. But the way you put it is like that he inherited wealth. That's also really interesting. We haven't mentioned that yet. But there is something about the great shadow of David. That like Shlomo, for all of his glory, he's not the great king of Israel. That was his dad. And we will come across at least one line in here that reminded me of that. So let's keep that in mind as well, that part of what Shlomo is, if these indeed can be seen as Shlomo's reflections, is someone who was like born, with a silver spoon in his mouth, someone who had it all to start with, someone who was a made man, who was all set up. And what do you do when you're born with everything? When you're the billionaire's kid or the celebrity's kid, or like where you have it all, but you haven't done anything to earn it. And what kind of particular restlessness and dissatisfaction that might not just be the human condition, but the condition of wealth, qua wealth, and then inherited legacy and wealth in addition to that. As I've done before, mostly selected the chapters or the sections that deal directly with wisdom. And he starts off right away here, just a little bit further on in the chapter. And okay, so we were just asking, what is this philosophy? Now let's try to ask, like, what is the philosophy of wisdom that is being you know, punted here just first. We'll see him return to it. But Ani Kohelet Haiti Melech Al Yisrael BeYerushalayim. I, Kohelet, was king in Jerusalem over Israel. Again, that sounds like Shlomo. V'natati et libi lidrosh v'latur b'chochma al kol asher na'asa tachat ha'shamayim. Hu inyan ra. Hu inyan ra natan Elokim livnei Adam la'anot bo. This, I want to try to figure out how to translate. I was doing this with Akiva a little bit earlier, but this is a funny sentence here. I have said this before, and let's just keep in mind that one of the words that recur throughout all of this literature is the heart, libi, 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 and I've retranslated it because mostly it gets translated as mind, but the word is heart, and heart means something like consciousness in ancient Hebrew, mind and heart, so we'll sort of keep that in mind. I set my heart to seek and to probe, lidrosh v'latur. Latur is literally like to scout out. It's a word that'll come back again. I set my heart to seek and to probe with wisdom all that happens under the sun. And I didn't know how to translate this, so in the end I just kind of left it as it was, but we'll struggle with this line a little. An unhappy business that which God gave people to be concerned with. An unhappy business that. Literally inyan ra, like a bad idea, a bad thing. A terrible thing. I observed all the happenings beneath the sun, and I found that hakol hevel ve'ra'ut ruach, and I found that everything is futile, vanishing in the wind. Ra'ut there is also, by the way, related to the language of shepherding, right? So there's another thing to pick up on. And this is another phrase that gets repeated. Everything is hevel and just sort of flowing like a shepherd would lead, like led away by the wind. Me'uvat lo yuchal litkon ve'chesron lo yuchal limanot. A twisted thing that cannot be made straight, a lack that cannot be made good. So I said to my heart, here I have become greater and wiser than any that ruled before me over Jerusalem, and my heart has zealously absorbed wisdom and learning. V'libi ra'a harbe chochma v'dat. That's another thing we were doing is tracking the many words for wisdom. Chochma, dat, bina. We've seen them all, so here are a couple. And so I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. Holilot v'sichlut. And I came to know that this too vanishes in the wind. And then here's some kind of, philosophical statement. Kiburov chochma, rav ka'as. V'yosif da'at, yosif mach'ov. For as wisdom grows, anger grows. And to increase knowledge is to increase pain. Okay, there we go. We now have some strong statements. But there's a lot in here, and I'm not sure entirely what to do with it all. I'm curious to hear if anything jumps out at you like a twisted thing that cannot be made straight. Is that life the twisted thing that cannot be made straight? There is futility, there is hevel, there is vanishing in the wind. But maybe the easiest way to start is with the last line there. I'm not sure about the first part. As wisdom grows, anger grows? What is that about? Pain also. But why anger? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a mislay, but ignorance is bliss.
Right, right. Yeah, right. But why is that so? Why do we say that? Because that is sort of a key.
It's a very Jewish thing. Like, we don't ever want answers. We want an opportunity for more questions. We're constantly diving deeper and deeper into whatever it is that we're exploring. And so, presumably, the more that one knows about something, the more upset you are about that. The more we learn about the world, the more we realize what a shit show it is. There are beautiful
things. Yeah.
It's seemingly this is on his theme of just like,
yeah.
Everything is that there is no good that can be found within, or at the end of the day. You keep trying to unravel the string, and every corner, there's a surprise that's painful, and there's more knots to be found.
Right, okay. So at the end, you were starting to say, like, the untangling never ends, and there's something sort of like, it's maddening, in a sense, to just keep. But in the beginning, you were saying something a little different, which I'm also fascinated by, which is that if you really understood, you might be disappointed. That's a terrifying philosophy. Not, it's not yours, but if it's here, that idea that maybe like ignorance really is bliss, because to truly understand, I don't know, the way human beings are, and I think some people feel this way, that you when you really start to face with courage the stark truth of the world, it is a terrible, this is Schopenhauer, right? Like, really look at the world and you will must admit that it is all just suffering and pain and uselessness. And people are, people are, yeah, people just ain't no good, right? As Nick Cave said. Maybe that's part of it, is that you, if you start to gain wisdom, you're outraged at the state of things. That's okay, that's fair. Yeah, Bracha.
Well, a lot of people can be outraged and do nothing about it. But looking further up, where it's in that weird statement, I'm fascinated with La Nokbo, that it's for us to be answerable to.
Yeah, yeah.
That we have some responsibility towards it.
Yeah, good. Right. So first of all, what you're saying is important. Shlomo is trying, or Kohelet is trying. I want to figure this out. And that isn't necessarily the Shlomo that we read about in Malachim. He just got wisdom and suddenly was so wise. But this Shlomo is trying to solve the chidah, the riddle of life, and that is vexing. But at least he's trying, and there's something to that. The phrase that you picked up on, I'm so glad you highlighted it, because this is the one that Akiva and I were kind of bouncing back and forth, or at least mostly I just asked him, what do you think of this? La'anotbo, you have to answer for it? The translation, an unhappiness that which God gave people to be concerned with. But the Hebrew is inyan ra, a terrible idea or a terrible thing, natan elokim livnei adam, gave God to people, la'anotbo, to answer for, or something like that. And so that's what I was wondering as well. And Akiva, who has such a lovely Hebrew, was like, oh, it sounds to me like it should be le'anot bo. I was like, le'anot? He's like, yeah, meaning to suffer for. And indeed, you looked it up, and we found one commentator, a contemporary of Rashi's here, Rav Yosef Kra, who explains it in just that way. If you look at the commentary on the bottom, inyan rahu, that is a terrible Pitrono inuira. Inyan ra should be read as a terrible suffering. A terrible suffering, who shenatan elokim livnei adam le'anotbo. And he goes on to say, yeah, it should be understood, though it's not read as le'anotbo, that God has caused, it's a terrible suffering that God has caused us to suffer. And that is another answer, and another Schopenhauer kind of answer is, the world is suffering. We just suffer. And that's actually not our fault. This is like, so far we've been condemning, humanity, but the world is suffering. Life is nasty, brutish, and short, and we just suffer in it, and it's God's fault. I mean, maybe that's what's being poked at here. It's like, what is, a terrible thing that God has given us to answer for, to suffer through, to be humbled by, to be oppressed by. Maybe that's part of the dilemma that Kohelet is grappling with. And that's a scary philosophy. Yeah.
Yeah, the thing that keeps coming across to me is just disappointment. And it leads back to the thing we were talking about in the very first class, where the first thing Solomon does is he solves this big problem with the child.
Yeah.
He starts off on this fantastically good foot. And many years later, it's like he started off high and it's been downhill ever since.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very disappointed person, of course.
Yeah, good. Okay, so that's a good... thanks for bringing us back to Solomon and his life. And that's a good thing to remember, and we will soon dig into it a little bit deeper. This idea that wisdom seemed at first to be a great asset to Shlomo. And then part of what we are processing as we process of his life is that he went totally off the rails. That he, the wisest of all men, ended up worshiping foreign gods and essentially letting the kingdom slip through his fingers, Right? So there's something about his wisdom that did not secure him a good end. And so here he is lamenting his end. Yeah, Joni.
It feels a little like a Bedouin. Wondering who is this legacy for? And also, I can't help feel how utterly disconnected he is from the community and where he's living, and that there is a whole world of humanity that is raising crops and having children, mm-hmm. and having relationships, mm-hmm. and have a theology that they've created. And so I'm just wondering.
Yeah, those are both really good questions. I mean, first of all, who's being addressed here? Who is Qohelet talking to? Is this for us? Are we to take on this? Is it only an aging king that has this perspective on life? Is it only a trillionaire and a genius that like has such an odd and perverse view of existence? Who is the receiver of this message? And yes, and then of course, you know, thank you for the first real pushback here on, isn't this just wrong? Isn't this contrary to everything that, I mean, we're all in some ways in this tradition that celebrates life and the business of life and the doing, and like, and who are you to say like it's all meaningless? And who are you to just sit there and condemn everything when like most of us are just like trying to get by and find some purpose to it all? Like there's something, it's just impossible to confront or to swallow here. Yeah. Okay.
Actually, I think when someone has a lot of certainty and clarity on how something ought to be done, whether it's because they're very knowledgeable or just because they have that clarity, it can be frustrating to work with people who don't have that clarity, who don't understand, you know, branding or the marketing approach or how a shul should be run. Mm-hmm. All these different things can be really frustrating when lots of people have an opinion and you're certain about it.
And who's certain here? Who's the one that's certain? Shlomo. Yeah, right. In other words, like, it's not easy to be the smartest guy in the room, you know? Trust me. No, I'm just kidding. We've discussed this before, that there's perhaps, and this is a little bit of an answer to the dilemma that Joni's proposing this, perhaps it was hard to be that wise, that it was hard to be that smart. Maybe like Avery was suggesting, like he saw behind the veil, and there's something terrifying about that, but also it's just so different. And he's the king, and he's the richest, he's not in human society. So, you know, what about the rest of us going on and, you know, making babies and just trying to, you know, eat good food and maybe daven three times a day if we're lucky and, you know, just like live good lives. But like that's like so far from his reality that, yeah.
We've been describing Shlomo, he is the wisest man, he is the richest man, seemingly he has more wives and concubines than any other man. I wonder if this is one of those things of like, he's almost attaining a godlike status of having the like hyperbolic state of everything, and so within that there's also a like, now that I have everything, I actually have nothing.
Yeah.
And so it's like, how can one actually, and I say that within the godlike of like, we think of God being as all-powerful, which means that it contains everything, the good and the bad, the evil and the positive. And so to think within like all of this that Shlomo is developing and growing and attaining, that he actually does find this full sense of futility as one of the translations here, or that like even with everything, it is all meaningless.
Right.
Because, you know, he sits alone in this exceptional state.
Good. Okay. That is another good pivot point to take us into him reflecting on all of that opulence. But it's also, I think, the way you phrased it leads me to another possible philosophy that emerges here. We've been talking about nihilism, but we might also talk about Stoicism, right? And some conclusion that actually maybe wealth and sex and wine and that is the problem, and that actually the conclusion is a simpler way of living. And that simpler way of living may include some pleasure, eat, drink, and be merry, or it may just be like, just basic, you know, just, you know, live a simple life. And, you know, somebody was talking about Greek and Roman influences before, right? So Stoicism also in the air, and that is another way of thinking about the conclusions we might come to. But let's, yeah.
There is one thing that feels, in some sense, subversive of a particular kind of Stoicism, which is the kind of meta-philosophical claim that wisdom itself is a part of all of that futility.
Yeah.
As opposed to the claim that, like, wisdom enables you
right.
to appreciate and be oriented in the world towards what's futile and holds you as a master over those things. Like, actually, wisdom in the project of trying to understand is a part of the whole futile thing that we need to get out of.
Okay, good. Okay, so now we've got three great pivots, because that also will take us directly into the next section, which is the next chapter, which sets up a kind of a problem. And at the core of the problem is one of the questions I posed at the outset. What is the value of wisdom? And this chapter that we just read tees it up a little bit when it says, "Va'etna libi ledat chokhma vedat," to know, I set my heart to know wisdom and, oh, sorry, ledat chokhma vedat holelot v'sichlut, and also to know holelot, like wildness, madness, and then sichlut, folly is maybe a good translation, but it's like silliness or simpleness, and there's a kind of a dichotomy here that the next chapter is going to take up. So I want to. This is when I said I'm having a hard time understanding Kohelet. This is really the chapter that I need the most help with, because there's a kind of a contest set up here in this next chapter where Shlomo is pitting wisdom and the pursuit of wisdom against something else. And I don't know what that other thing is. Is folly the right translation, or riches part of the problem? But there's some sort of either or here, and I'm not sure if we ever decide. But listen to this dilemma that begins in chapter 2. Tartib v'libi, there's that word again, I scouted out my heart. Tartib v'libi, limshoch b'yayin et basari. I let my heart venture out to tempt my flesh with wine. Okay, and now, and to take a hold of folly while letting my heart direct me with wisdom. V'libi noheg b'chochma, v'le'echoz b'sichlut. So both things. It's a hard sentence to even understand. I let my heart be directed with wisdom, while at the same time I took a hold of folly, fun, pleasure, silliness, stupidity. Ad asher ereh eiza tov libnei adam, so that in the end I might learn which one is good, which of the two was better for people, asher yasu tachat hashamayim mispar yamei chayehem, for people to do under the heavens in the few days they have. That's a weird idea. I let myself be guided by wisdom and also tried to grab on to foolishness or silliness, or I like sichlut is an interesting word as well that we'll tease out a little bit more. But let's just build a little bit on this. I did great things. Higdalti maasai. I did great things. I built myself houses and I planted vineyards. I laid out gardens and orchards in which I planted every kind of fruit tree. I constructed pools of water enough to irrigate a forest shooting up with trees. I acquired male and female servants, household stewards. I also acquired more cattle, both herds and flocks, than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Does this sound like our guy? This is our guy, right? I then amassed silver and gold and all the treasures of kings and states, and I got myself male and female singers, who knows what else they did, and all the human pleasures, spilling out in abundance. And so I gained more wealth than anyone before me in Jerusalem. Okay. That's Shlomo, right? And yet, my wisdom remained with me. Af chochmati amdali. So I was like, I had all this stuff, I built all this stuff, I had all the pleasure and the riches and the everything and the accomplishment. It's also accomplishment. Higdalti maasai. But my wisdom was still with me. I withheld from my eyes nothing they asked for, and I denied my heart no enjoyment. For my heart rejoiced in all my work, כי ליבי שמח מכל עמלי, וזה היה חלקי מכל עמלי. And I don't know how to translate this exactly either, but my heart was happy with all my work, and that was what I got out of my work. Or is that, that was all I got out of my work? You know? But that was all I got out of my work? And exactly, like there's something, is it defeatist at the end, or is that okay? Like my heart was happy? Okay, then there's two turns. And then this one you kind of expect. Ufaniti, and I turned to look at all that I had built up, all of my accomplishments, to all the work that I had done, and oh, it was all futile. Vehine hakol hevel, ve'ru'ut ruach, and vanishing in the wind, ve'ein yitron tachat ha-shemesh, and there was no value under the sun. That we've seen before. So now we have real images, and it was all hevel. But then he says, Ufaniti, and I turned again to look lirot chokhma v'holelot v'sichlut, to look at wisdom and, again, wildness and folly. For what is, and this is the line I was thinking of, for what is the person who comes after the king, who has already done it all? That's my translation, if you can argue with it. Ki me adam shiyavo achrei ha-melech et asher kvar asuhu. I found that wisdom is superior to folly. Reiti ani shiyesh yitron lachochma min asichlut. Oh, great, we decided. Wisdom is better. Then we can all go home. Wisdom is superior to folly, as light is superior to darkness. Hechacham einav v'rosho. A wise man has eyes in his head, whereas uchsil b'choshech olech. But a fool walks in darkness. Well, okay, wisdom it is. But I also realize that the same fate awaits them both. V'yadati gam ani shemikre echad yikre et kulam. So I said in my heart, the fate of the fool is also destined for me. To what advantage, then, have I been wise? And so I said in my heart that that, too, is futile, because the wise man, just like the fool, is not remembered forever. Ki ein zichron lechacham im haksil leolam. For as the succeeding days roll by, both are forgotten. Alas, the wise man dies just like the fool. And then listen to this. Vesaneti et hachaim. And so I loathed life. For everything that goes on under the sun seemed terrible to me, because everything is futile and vanishes in the wind. Ah, so there's like a problem here I can't quite figure out. What did he set out to do? What is the mission here? I wanted to be wise and stupid at the same time. I wanted to be wise and have fun at the same time. I wanted to be, you know, clear-headed but also indulgent at the same time. Like, what? How do you understand the project that Shlomo has set up for himself? Yeah, that's right.
It's always self-centered. If you kind of imagine life to the service that you're doing for the future generations, all that is nonsense. But if you consider your life, then it's completely self-centered on Kohelet. So it's a different perspective to consider always you.
Good, okay.
Goes to nothing.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, I just keep thinking of the word self-pity. Like, for a lot of what we've read so far, it's like, I'm doing all things, I've tried all these things. And there's excuses here, too. It's like, well, yeah, you slept with a lot of women, so is that because you were trying to enjoy life?
Right.
Like, bullshit.
Yeah.
You want to sleep with women. Right. So just this, I don't know, I get this sense of, like, this is almost like, it feels a little bit like, here's my excuse for how I lived. And woe is me that it didn't turn out the way I thought it was going to.
Good. All right. I see more. Let's keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me was he says, I did great things. You didn't build the houses. You didn't plant the vineyards. You didn't do the gardening. You didn't plant the orchards. You didn't construct the pools. I mean, you know, it was like, you know, I was the CEO.
Yeah.
To do it, but I never dirtied my fingernails.
Beautiful. So first of all, when you say I never dirtied my fingernails, David was famously, like one description is like all his hands were always dirty with the mess of life, but he certainly waged wars, went to battle, and you're right, again, this idea that like the privileged kid, and your critique is so searing, both because Shlomo literally didn't do it, but conscripted workers to do it for him. But also, so there's the like, you didn't do it, you're the CEO. And also like, what about God? isn't God the CEO? Like, you were such a big shot. Like, wasn't God going to build his house here on earth? Like, so there's like many layers to that critique. Okay, great. Yeah.
We also see him come up to the limits of his wisdom. Yeah. Because we know that, I mean, sort of trying to use the wisdom of deciding between a life of wisdom and a life of folly. He wants the wisdom involved while he's evaluating life of folly. But then when he gets to the end, when he starts talking about what makes a life worthwhile, we see how inadequate it is, you know, it's a self-centered life.
Yeah.
You know, who's going to remember me, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, establishing, you know, what you were, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Sure,
I do. What we were talking about earlier, the inadequacy of that kind of thing.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, I'm still puzzled because there's some, like, Mark's talking about the limits of wisdom, the inadequacy of wisdom.
Of his wisdom.
Yeah. And the way that it led him to, you know, unhappiness and disaster. But does he, in the end, his disappointment doesn't seem to be that his wisdom reached its limits, but that actually, like, this is part of the strange thing about this chapter, is that it's also like, but it didn't do me any good. Like, I'm not going to be remembered for it. Yeah, yeah.
That's the limit of the wisdom.
That is also, yeah.
But one thing that really stands out is, okay, so you could say he didn't do any of these things and he had a pretty easy life and had inheriting all this wealth. But one of the main things Solomon did is he built the temple, which was one of the greatest accomplishments.
Right.
And you talk about something that is not forgotten. We may forget how bright, smart he was and how wealthy and how much fun he had, but the temple is something his people still remember. There's not a mention of it.
Right.
And by him, he doesn't even think about it.
Right.
I think there's a lot of times in life where we may do something that we don't know the impact that it has. Right, so it's like he may do.
Not a minor.
Well, no, but that doesn't mean like if
just
he's
didn't
here,
appreciate it.
Right, and if he's here reflecting on all the things that he did, this is one of many, and he doesn't know at this time that's going to be the thing that lasts.
Yeah. Oh, there's so much interesting stuff going on here. First of all, I want to return to that critique. Right? Did he? He didn't build it. Right. So that's part of it. The other part of it is your comment, which is he built it, but he built the temple that was promised to his father. That his father, in a sense, had earned. Having said that, so there's like the either or here, the this and here. But there's also your point is strong because he did something so marvelous, a house for God on earth. Like, just sit there and reflect on that. Like, you brought down God from the heavens and created a place for God to dwell on earth. And you're right, in a way, that's his legacy for us. We're happy with that. We just mourned the loss of the temple. Why is he not celebrating his accomplishment? And instead it's like the cattle and the pools of water and I built myself houses. What about the house of God that you built, right? Yeah, so the point stands, yeah.
I think there's a reason he's not mentioning that. Mm. Because where did he get all this wisdom? It was a gift from God.
Mm.
Maybe his anger is at God.
Mm.
And maybe that's why he's not mentioning the connection to God, the main thing, the temple.
Mm. His anger, so finish that thought. His anger is at God because God cursed him with wisdom?
Something about his feeling devastated by it when he was counting on this to be the answer.
Yeah.
And right. That was the gift, that was the connection.
Right, and that makes that thing, because he asked for it, right? He asked for, God was so pleased, he asked for a Lev Shomea, a knowing or an understanding heart, and God said, I'm going to give you exactly what you asked for. And then it turns out to be like the genie in the bottle, like, you asked for that, I'm going to give it to you in a way that will make you regret it for the rest of your life, right?
That he doesn't mention God.
Yeah.
In this.
That's right. That's right.
And it's like he's avoiding God like the plague because God is the one that really disappointed him.
Right. Yeah, it is a book, you know.
It's not about the women. It's not about the wealth. It's not about any of this. It's about his relationship with God, which feels shattered.
Right. It's a book which is not absent of God, but doesn't turn to God often. And that is also an interesting thing in this. Hey, we talked about books being included in our Tanakh. Like Song of Songs, like, what's it doing there? No, it's all about God. But this book is not all about God. Like, what God comes up here and there, but it does not seem to be all about God. And I think that is, the absence is prominent.
Yes.
Yeah. Shana.
Why is not being remembered forever or being forgotten, why is that the, like, deciding factor?
Yeah. Yeah, good. Thanks for bringing us to that. Yeah, because there he sets it up, and it's sort of strange. Mark described it nicely, like, I'm going to kind of do both. I'm going to live both lives at once, and I'm going to, like, be, you know, somehow I'm going to hold it all together. And, yeah, like, you would think, oh, and it didn't work. Wisdom won't work in that way. He reached the limits of his wisdom. But actually, like, that's what I also, I can't make sense of the fact that at the end, it's not that wisdom was bad. It's just that it doesn't do you any better than foolishness. And the reason that they're equal seems to be that the both of us fade into the wind. We are not remembered. We don't yet.
What she said, to not be remembered forever, and him comparing a wise man dying to a fool dying,
mm-hmm.
It just sounds like he's near the end of his life and he's afraid of dying.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, look, that's, maybe that's, that it's so, what you said is so simple and so devastating. Like, maybe that, like, that is a dilemma, that this is like a book about death and about how death presents us with this, the meaninglessness here is like in the shadow of death. Like, we could do anything in the world. We could build a house for God on earth, but in the end, we're gone. Like, and maybe that's the, like, the great dilemma that, you know, there are answers, but it's a devastating question, and maybe that's what he's grappling with here. Yeah.
I was going to say also, like, the disappointment that life didn't work the way he thought it would.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When he asked for the heart of wisdom, and now he's at the end, it's like, oh, is that what I want?
Yeah. 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 I must wonder with you, like, what did he want? What was it that he was trying to do? I mean, originally, in the story of Melachim, what is it that he thought he would get from this understanding heart, and what did he hope his legacy would be? And also, in this formulation, what was he hoping he could do, be like, you know, wise, but also, like, foolish, and to be like, I mean, I, there's something about this I get, you know, like, I'd like to be like a really incredible, pious, religious person, and also have all the fun of, you know what I mean? Like, I know what that, some of what that balance is all about, and how precarious it would be. So, but I wonder, what is it that he's hunting for? Yeah.
Well, I think that fear of death is more to end up here, because arguably the ultimate wisdom would be that's the fate of all things.
Right.
Animate, inanimate, perhaps even, you know, whatever, like you Latin, the fate got them all.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what happens, and we ignore that as our peril.
Right, yeah.
We're totally unprepared for something that we see happening all over.
Right.
These things going away.
Yeah. Yeah, and we talked about Buddhist impermanence before. I don't know much about Buddhism, but I was struck by someone telling me once that Tibetan Buddhists meditate on death every day. That's like a core meditation to really get to, you know, what's wisdom, you know? To really wrap your mind around the fact that you will die. That is the way it works, and everything does. And to somehow be okay with that, and if you are not, well, doesn't matter what you have built. This is like in another school, like the Denial of Death. There's a book called The Denial of Death. There's like psychoanalyst Ernest Becker, I think his name is, who argues that all of our building and all of our accomplishments and our desire to have children and everything is just this, like, this desperate attempt to push off the fear of our impending demise. And can we leave something lasting? But no, that too will be forgotten. That too will be everything will be forgotten. So I hand in the back. Yeah? No. Okay, yeah.
Just another thing I don't remember. How did he die, Solomon? Did he die? Did it just say Solomon died? Because with David, we have this whole long death.
Yeah, right.
With, Bathsheba, and then warning Solomon you know, take his revenge on all his enemies. But the point is you get the feeling with David, he's surrounded by people to the end. He does not die alone. And I don't...
How does Shlomo die, Kiva? I don't even know if that's mentioned. The fact that the question's difficult to answer is a point in itself, right? The Book of Kings begins with David on his deathbed, and that's what starts all the drama. Right. And Shlomo is condemned by God, though God says, I'll tear the kingship away from your children and not you. And it's just sort of like the story kind of fades away from there. Yeah.
I was gonna say, he sounds like someone who like wants grandchildren.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, there are people who don't have children. Lifetime have meaningful ends of their lives. Yeah. Like, it sounds like he's looking for some sort of legacy.
Yeah.
That will continue.
You know, if I remember correctly, this, like, vasaneti et ha'chaim, and I loathe life, Rashi says, like, that what he loathed was that he was thinking of his children who also went astray. And it's like Rehovam, who also, like, becomes, like, a wicked king. And there's something about like legacy here. And you want to read it to us? What do we have?
Okay. The other events of Solomon's reign and all his actions and wisdom are recorded in the books of the Annals of Solomon. The length of Solomon's reign in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years. Solomon slept with his fathers, was buried in his father David. It's not some long, I don't believe it's some long...
Okay, all right.
He's just warned his son is, you know, the kingdom. You know, look, they tell David his son is going to succeed him. He's going to be the ruler of a great kingdom. They tell that Solomon is told by God at the very end.
Yeah.
Guess what? Your whole kingdom is going to collapse under your son or something.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we just everything. That's not a great way to go.
Yeah, right. Right, and Solomon is both, rests on all, to return again to Eric's comment, that Solomon rests on all the glory of David's kingdom, but unlike David, he kind of goes out with shame instead of glory. I mean, first of all, I want to name some of the things that we have, some of the important things that we've done. And one is right from the start to place the emphasis on his ego and his self and his, even the language here is just like, what's going on inside of me and who will I be and will I be wise? But it's like, and everything I built, and it's like, you were the king of an entire nation. Like, does anything else but you matter, right? That's an important, and it's sort of glaring, but easy to miss part of the problem here is maybe the cause of suffering is the obsession with exactly this. And then to build on that, and if I am obsessed with myself, then the greatest fear of all is that I will end. I will be gone. I can build the biggest building in the world, but I will one day not be here, and that in itself is, there's no way around that. Okay, I want to make sure we get to this last image because it is the one that is most sort of startling to me, and it's also just, it's written in this cool kind of parable-like way. This is now towards the end of Ecclesiastes, and suddenly Kohelet says this really interesting thing, which I noticed because once again we mention kings, and once again we mention wisdom. So listen to this. Ir ktana v'anashim ba me'at. There was a little city with few men in it. Uva leha melech gadol. And to it came a great king. V'savavota uvana leha mitzodim gadolim, who surrounded it and built mighty fortresses to defend it. Present in the city was a poor wise man who might have saved it with his wisdom. But nobody thought of that poor man. V'lo zachar et ha'ish ha'miskin ha'hu. Literally, nobody remembered. Nobody remembered that poor, poor wise man. V'amarti ani, tova chochma migvura. So I said to myself, I realized, wisdom is better than power. V'chochmat ha'misken bzuya, u'dvarav enam nishma'im. But a poor man's wisdom is scorned, and his words are not heeded. Like a difficult little parable here. So What is the moral here? I mean, and how do we fit it into the last one? We've been talking about wisdom and foolishness and wisdom and foolishness and this like this debate between what is better, but now it's a different debate. It's like the mighty king versus the wise, miserable, poor man. And it is, once again, I admit wisdom is better than power in this case, and he had both. But if you're wise and not powerful, then nobody listens to you anyway.
When you're rich, they think you know.
So, like, who is Solomon here? I mean, it's like, is Solomon in this parable? What do you think he's saying here? There was a little city with a few men in it. Now, maybe that's not Jerusalem. Some other imagines it, a tiny little city. Uvale melech gadol v'savavota. And to it came a great king who surrounded it. And that surrounded it, that sounds like threatening. Maybe
conquered it?
Yeah, conquered it. And built great fortresses to defend it. And it's like, is the king the king of the city or is the king against the city?
Is there a word for defend? I don't see the word for defend.
Well, mitzodim is like fortresses or bulwarks.
Fortresses.
Yeah.
So,
in other words,
defend, then it looks like he's attacking.
Right. Okay. Maybe to attack it. Right. Yeah. Fair. And what do you think the poor wise man is? I don't know. Like, he had the answer. What do you think he would have said? And poor here is not like ani, like poverty, but miskin, a miserable, an unfortunate wise man, right? And he could have saved the city, but nobody remembered him. Right? Yeah.
Well, maybe he thinks he's doubting his own wisdom, that the only reason people ever listened to him is because he was wealthy.
Right. It's like, what? I had such wisdom, but yeah, people came to hear it, but they came because I was the king. They came because I was rich. Like, actually, maybe it wasn't my wisdom that distinguished me after all. It was my power, because I can give you a parable of a city where there's like a powerful person and a wise person. Wise person means nothing. It's the power that wins. Wisdom is better than power. Sure, I'll admit that to you, but it doesn't actually win at the end of the day. Well, it's a dilemma, and we're also almost out of time, so let's take a look at an unpacking of this image from the Talmud in Nedarim. V'amar Rami Bar Abba, Rabbi Baba said, my diktiv, ir ktanav anashim, what is the meaning of that which is written, there was a little city with few men in it? Ir ktana zehaguf, a little city, this is the body. Vanashim ba me'at, and the few men are in it, these are the limbs. Uvala melech gadol v'savavota, and to it came a great king who surrounded it. This is the evil inclination. Built mighty fortresses to defend it. Elu avanot, these are the sins. So maybe conquered it and then maintained the conquest through sins. Now there was found in a poor wise man, this is the good inclination, who might have saved the city with his wisdom. Oh, sorry, who might have saved the city with his wisdom. This is repentance and good deeds. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. It means that when the evil inclination is there, no one remembers the good inclination.
I think that miskin actually can't really be translated into English.
Mm.
Like, it doesn't necessarily, I think you said earlier that it isn't necessarily an oni, like somebody who's
right.
Wealth. It's somebody who is disregarded. It's mm-hmm. somebody who exists on the outskirts, like a homeless person, or somebody who you see every day but you don't notice them. Mm-hmm. It's somebody who is always overlooked.
Yeah.
He's not saying that you have to be powerful in order to be listened to, but rather that it's an admonition to us to open our ears, mm-hmm. to recognize what's around us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are we talking about Solomon here in 59, or is it possible that this is more about, like, Torah being a poor wise man that was neglected?
Yeah, I mean, it's good.
And also thinking of like a little city, it's like, no, there's this small people, the Hebrews,
yeah.
and they have this thing called Torah, but they neglected it. It's full of this wisdom.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful and it's wonderful.
Yeah.
But as Solomon and others pull away from it, and we saw that when we analyze like his story and, you know, his pursuit of Egyptian horses and others.
Well, are you talking historically where he's brave? You know, this is already the time where Judaism is in decline, mm-hmm. and Christianity is taking over. So are you saying that this is like rabbis are bewailing the fact that, you know, we have sort of the truth, but it doesn't matter because we have no power in this horrible other religion, no so disrespect to any Christians.
I'm not in the Talmud here. I'm actually with Shlomo. He's writing Ecclesiastes. He's a dying king.
Okay.
And realizes the error in his ways of abandoning the Torah, which could have saved him, which could have saved his kingdom.
Yeah, I mean, this is, right, this king is, this isn't Jerusalem, and this king isn't Shlomo exactly, but it, the whole thing is framed as a king in Jerusalem writing this, right? So this king is maybe an attacking, an evil king, the one with the power but not the wisdom, and as the Talmud takes it up, the king is actually the Yetzer Hara, the evil within us, right? And that's an interesting thing, if like, Shlomo is the king that we've been thinking about the whole time. And I think that if the Talmud piece does nothing else, it is meant to tell us that this idea of like a king looking over his palace and his fortress and his life and his accomplishments, this is like the epitome of that image is King Solomon. King Solomon, who had it all and who had all the wisdom and had all the pleasure and could play out this kind of human experiment to the very end. But ultimately, I think the Talmud is asking us to see this as a dilemma that we all grapple with. That, you know, we all build our own little lives and we all try to summon wisdom, but we are pulled by all of these other forces. And wisdom is not necessarily a defense against these forces, right? Yeah, we celebrate wisdom, we strive for wisdom, we valorize wisdom, but there are other things in us, our desires for power and for wealth, and just to last forever, that wisdom cannot think our way through our end. And there is a kind of a limit to our wisdom. There's only for even the wisest and most powerful of all people eventually went astray. And so what hope is there for us? Whatever it is, it must be something beyond wisdom, or at least it must be wisdom plus something else. And what is that? Torah, humility, you know, the help of other people, love. There are other forces in the world. There are other virtues that we have to bring into our little city, because wisdom is one of our chief values, but wisdom alone, Shlomo teaches us, and we all have to learn for ourselves, wisdom alone will not suffice.